Court. This case is about whether a criminal defendant has the right to communicate with counsel during the course of a guilty plea. Now, our position in this case is, had my client been allowed to talk to his counsel during the course of his plea colloquy, there would not have been an appeal, there would not have been a trial, and there wouldn't have been a life sentence in this case. Now, there are two assignments of error on appeal. The first is whether or not the district court violated my client's right to counsel when he prevented my client's attorney from participating meaningfully in the hearing and prevented my client's attorney from speaking with Mr. Juarez during the course of the plea colloquy.
You mean in private?
Yes.
I mean, there was nothing to prohibit him from just turning to his client there during the colloquy and talking to him.
Actually, I think, Your Honor, that the record is quite clear that there wasn't an opportunity for him to do that. The judge was questioning my client quite vigorously, and my client, understandably, was trying to respond to the judge. And it's hard to explain the dynamics of the courtroom. Courtrooms are different. Different situations are different. But I think the record in this case is clear that there was no opportunity for my client and his trial lawyer to communicate during the course of the hearing.
Well, the court actually offered him a recess at one point, did he not, Judge Ellis?
That's correct, Your Honor. And mm-hmm. I think that...
And his court said, do we need a brief recess? And then counsel didn't say yes. He just said, I believe the distinction is the word transport. And Mr. Juarez has difficulty distinguishing. So the court afforded him the opportunity at that point, and it looks like counsel declined it.
Your Honor is absolutely right that the court at that point offered him the opportunity to speak with his client. However, a couple points here. One, the fact that he didn't take the opportunity at that time doesn't mean that he waived the opportunity to communicate with his client later in the hearing. The way I see the record, Mr. Juarez's attorney thought that he could resolve this issue by explaining the issue to the court. And he tried to do that twice. And what actually happened after he did state what Your Honor just quoted regarding Mr. Juarez's problem with comprehension, the court then didn't really respond to that problem. The court continued to press Mr. Juarez regarding transportation, whether he transported the victim in this case. And I think counsel made a judgment at that point that he could resolve this issue by talking with his client in private. And he was prevented from doing that. I mean, he was impliedly prevented from doing that. He never had a chance to talk to him. Now, the government takes the position that this is not a de novo issue. And we respectfully submit that the government is wrong on that point.
Okay, before you get to that, though, why wasn't it up to the defense counsel to ask the court to rule on the second request for a recess? Looks like counsel said, may I have a five-minute recess? And the court, not responding, said, you can't accept the charge and plead guilty in this court unless you actually transported this young woman. And then counsel kind of drops the idea of a recess. Why isn't it incumbent upon counsel not just to suggest it, but to say, Your Honor, I'm asking the court for this. I'm asking the court to rule on this.
Your Honor, I think in terms of preserving this issue, Rule 51 is fairly clear. I think once the counsel asked for the recess and the judge effectively ignored him, again, it's hard to recreate or imagine the dynamics of that courtroom, but the way I read the record, the judge clearly was saying no by not answering that question and continuing with the judge's own statement. And I think that in terms of Rule 51, the error is clearly preserved because he asked for it and he impliedly was denied. I don't think it's incumbent upon him to keep repeating the relief that he was requesting. And furthermore, I think it's pretty clear from this record that the judge was somewhat agitated by this point in the hearing. And counsel, it might have been obvious to counsel that it would have been pointless to continue to press this issue. Now, with respect to the standard of review on this point, we sharply disagree with the government. We believe that the Smith case is definitive with respect to this issue, in that the Smith case says that with respect to the question of whether effective counsel was or wasn't available, the appropriate standard of review is de novo. The government wants to cast this as a continuance issue, but it's really not. What this really is a question of whether a defendant can briefly talk to his lawyer in the course of a critical proceeding in the process. And I think the Smith case answers that question definitively. And I think the Smith case also very clearly explains what defines a functioning attorney-client relationship. And the way the Smith court explains that is that communication is the benchmark of an attorney-client relationship. The client doesn't have legal knowledge, but the client understands the facts, and the client has the right to make decisions. His attorney has the legal knowledge and the ability to speak on his behalf. And from this record, I think it's clear that Mr. Juarez didn't have counsel in this case, because counsel wasn't allowed to advocate his client's position. Counsel wasn't allowed to make a record, really, on behalf of his client. And effectively, it's as if he wasn't even there. And given that course of events, our position is that the completeness of the absence of representation in this case should be viewed as a structural error. And when a structural error occurs in this context, prejudice is presumed. But if this court is not willing to take a view that this is a structural error, we believe that the prejudice in this record is clear. First of all, the prejudice is that the counsel didn't have an opportunity to make a record on behalf of his client before we ever get to the other consequences of his inability to talk to his client. Secondly, there is no record. I misspoke. There's certainly a reasonable probability of a different outcome in this case. Because, as any experienced attorney knows, unforeseen circumstances come up in the course of hearings all the time. And we're able to talk to our clients, we're able to calm our clients down, we're able to understand our client's position and explain it to the court in a way that could resolve the problem. And what Mr. Juarez's attorney would have had to do in this case wouldn't have been, as the government suggests, to move heaven and earth. Mr. Juarez's attorney could have resolved this problem in any number of ways. One, he could have proffered the facts that would have satisfied the court that Mr. Juarez transported the victim. Two, he could have had Mr. Juarez proffer those facts himself. Three, he could, if given the opportunity, explain the problem to the court in some detail so that the court could ask the right questions. Now, the government cites in its brief a case called Hernandez-Rivas as an example of a case where someone categorically denied an element of the offense. And I would say that, first, this case is substantially different from that case because Mr. Juarez was denying the word transport, but if he were questioned further, it would have become clear that, in fact, he did certainly aid and abet in the transportation of this victim. And I think Hernandez-Rivas is actually a good example of the proper way that the court should have gone about conducting the plea colloquy in this case when counsel alerted him to the fact that Mr. Juarez doesn't comprehend the term transport. And I'd just like to make a brief note here. I don't think it's just merely an argument that a defendant like Mr. Juarez wouldn't understand a legal concept like transport.
Let me ask you this question. When I would take guilty pleas as a trial judge, and I'd be talking to the defendant, and I'm trying to make sure he understands what his rights are. I try to make sure he understands what he's accused of, and to make sure he understands that and admits that he's guilty of the crime with which he's charged. And I'm asking him questions, and when I get to questions about, do you understand, did you do what you're accused of? And he starts to equivocate with me, and he starts to hedge. What I would have happen, a lot of times the lawyer would say, let me talk to him a second. The lawyer would pull him aside, and then he'd come back and say, yes, I'm guilty, and answer my question correctly. And it always made me nervous as to what they talked about, because I was always worried that the lawyer may just say to him, just say yes. Right. And he comes back up there and he says, yes. And I was never comfortable questioning the defendant, what did your lawyer tell you? I never did that. But it always made me nervous, because I didn't know what the lawyer was telling him when he pulled him aside, spoke to him in private, and then he came back and the defendant answers my questions correctly. What is a judge to do when this situation occurs and the defendant is equivocating as to the guilt of the charge to which he's pleading guilty. What's a judge to do when he equivocates and the lawyer wants to talk to him in private?
I think that the judge certainly has an obligation, as Your Honor explained, and an important one, to make sure that the defendant admits to facts. The law is that the defendant has to admit to facts that would amount to satisfying each of the elements of the offense. The court is certainly right that the court has a role, an important one, to do that. I think the best case that illustrates this is...
I'm just asking practice. You would say the defendant has a right, constitutional right, to stop the proceedings and consult with his lawyer in private.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because first of all, considering the dynamics of the situation, for most criminal defendants, this is the scariest day in their life. And the courtroom is a very intimidating environment. And for them to understand a legal concept such as transport and aiding and abetting and the breadth of that concept, a person with a seventh grade education who doesn't speak English could very reasonably think that to transport would be to drive a vehicle. It's a very reasonable understanding. And in your honor's example, what I would tell my client is, remember what I explained. Any of the following things could be transport. Please tell the judge what you did. And I certainly wouldn't have him not tell the truth, but I would have him tell the judge affirmatively what he did. And I think the Maddox case from D.C. actually illustrates this point, because there in that case, the defendant came up before the court and the judge said, did you sell these drugs? And the defendant says, no, I didn't. And then later the defendant asked for a new plea hearing, and in his letter to the court, he explained, I didn't sell the drugs myself, but I did acts that certainly qualify as aiding and abetting. And I think that's the challenge we face, is that when our clients are being grilled the way that Mr. Juarez was being grilled in this situation, and he was left to fend for himself. I think the record is clear on that. He was being grilled by the judge, and he was being left to fend for himself. I'm not saying Judge Ellis intended to do anything wrong. I think Judge Ellis intended to ensure that this plea was going to be valid and that it was going to hold if Mr. Juarez ever appealed it. But
you know, we've got case law that says if the lawyer tells the client something wrong, that's incorrect, he can get the plea vacated. And so what I'm saying is you could have a situation where the lawyers pulled him aside, told him something wrong, and he comes back in front of the judge and answers the question the way the judge, you know, they would allow the judge to proceed with a guilty plea. And there's no way for the judge to protect himself, so to speak, to make sure that the defendant really understands what he's pleading guilty to, admitting guilt.
I understand Your Honor's point. I have a few seconds here left, if I may just briefly answer. Sure. I think in that situation, and I think what Mr. Williams wanted to do was he wanted to get on the record what Mr. Juarez was willing to admit. When he was being questioned by Judge Ellis, he was saying a lot of what he didn't do because he got defensive. But in that situation, if he clearly stated on the record what he did do, we would have a clear record as to whether that constitutes transporting or aiding and abetting in transporting.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. Let's hear from the government.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court, Patricia Giles on behalf of the United States. The defendant presents his argument as if the court rejected this plea as a rush to judgment, and as if the court chose expediency, as in the sense of moving his docket along, instead of looking at the defendant's rights in terms of our ability to enter a plea. And that's just not the case here. First of all, Judge Ellis is very experienced and well-regarded and is known for being very thorough and careful. And that's exactly what he did in this plea colloquy. He wasn't rushing. He spent a lot of time asking this defendant questions, not only about his background, but about the terms of the plea to make sure that he understood. And at the outset of it, of the entire plea colloquy, he explained, I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and my focus is to make sure, one, that this plea is knowing and voluntary, and two, that it's supported by a factual basis. Because in this court, you can't plead guilty unless you did what you're pleading guilty to. That's at pages 35 and 36 of our joint appendix. So from the outset, the court let this defendant know what his purpose was. And the reason that this plea fell apart was because the defendant was denying his guilt. This was gamesmanship, and it started not just at the plea colloquy, it started before the plea colloquy. Because as it's alluded to in the joint appendix when we were on the day of trial then before Judge O'Grady, was that the statement of facts, the one that he stood up before Judge Ellis and said was not true, was the statement of facts that the defendant negotiated. But yet, when he gets before the judge, he says, well, when the court and the defendant understood all of Judge Ellis's questions, even one, the ones that were compound, he understood and followed along. Because counsel indicates that he had a seventh grade education, but what he told the court was that he had an education equal to 10 years in the United States, and that he also did air conditioning work, which is a technical skill which requires some ability, you know, some amount of intelligence and education. And the defendant understood all of Judge Ellis's questions, but when he got to the question about the statement of facts, and with the plea agreement, it was a compound question. Is that your signature at the end? And does that fairly and accurately reflect the terms of your plea agreement? Yes, to both questions. When he got to the statement of facts, is that your signature on the statement of facts? And is it true and accurate? Excuse me? That was what the defendant's response was. Judge Ellis repeated the same question. The defendant said, well, that's my signature and it was translated for me. And when Judge Ellis said, I want to know if it's true and accurate, the defendant said, well, supposedly for the agents that are accusing me. And Judge Ellis said, I want to know what you say. Well, it's not the truth. The whole reason that we were before the court was for a plea agreement. That by signing it ahead of time, the defendant said, this plea agreement is supported by this statement of facts, and it is accurate and true. But when he got to court, he said it wasn't accurate and true. And there began the unraveling. Judge Ellis still, and counsel now says that at the time of the colloquy that the attorney didn't have a chance to speak with his client. He may not have been able to speak with him in private, but he was standing side by side. And at certain points, he did whisper something to him. And so he did have the opportunity to consult with his attorney at any point. He had the opportunity to consult with him well before the plea, because it's also stated in the joint appendix that they went by the plea agreement and statement of facts line by line. And as I stated, this is the same statement of facts that he helped negotiate. When Judge Ellis then began asking him specific questions about the underlying facts, that's when the defendant also denied his guilt. When that judge asked him, did you do what's charged in count two? He said, well, I was there. That is not an admission of guilt. Then the judge went on to say, well, tell me in your own words exactly what you did. Judge Ellis explained that twice. Counsel argues, well, if he had been given the opportunity to ask what he did, then he could have explained. But Judge Ellis gave him many opportunities. He asked the questions in a variety of ways. He asked the general questions about, tell me in your own words what you did. He asked him that twice at pages 61 and 62 of the joint appendix. He asked him, did you do what's charged in count two? That's when the defendant said, I was just there. When Judge Ellis then asked him, and pointed him to specifically the statement of facts when they were talking about the December car trip. He said, were you in a car with this girl on December 6th? The defendant said, yes. But at that time, and he began to then minimize his conduct, what he said, we were only there that time only, I and a friend of mine. We only went to pick her up with another friend of hers. That day, we only went to pick her up. But then after we picked her up with the other guy, two blocks further ahead, the police stopped us. So that's what's happened, and that's why I was there at that moment. Well, that's not what happened. And first of all, that question wasn't even responsive to what the judge asked, because what the judge asked was, first, were you in the car? And then his next question was, what was that girl there for? And as I stated, every other response the defendant had ever given in the time of that colloquy was responsive to Judge Ellis's question. But there, he sidestepped it, because he didn't talk about what the girl was there for. He talked about him and a friend going to pick her up. And Judge Ellis picked up on that as well as all of these other times where he did not accept and acknowledge what he did. This was just not about the distinction between drive and the word transport, Because even here in this excerpt, he's talking about, we picked her up. We picked her up. It's not just about him driving the car or whether he didn't drive the car. And then Judge Ellis asks other questions. Did you participate at all in transporting this girl? Because that would have captured arranging the ride, which he did on numerous occasions. That would have also captured the bus trips that he went on with this girl this 12-year-old, in order for her to prostitute. He didn't admit it there either. And then at the end, and finally at the end, Judge Ellis asked, did you, not using the word transport even, did you take this girl with another person? Take this girl somewhere for the purpose of her engaging in prostitution? And what did the defendant say? That's what I said, but it's not true. So we, given this record and all of these repeated denials of this defendant, there was no factual basis upon which to accept this plea. In terms of the five-minute recess, just because counsel casts this as a denial of the right to counsel argument doesn't make it so. Judge Ellis was not denying Mr. Warris his right to counsel. As I stated, he had the opportunity to confer with him prior to the plea, during the course of the plea, and then after the plea. This colloquy wasn't on the day of trial. It's 3 weeks before. He still had every opportunity to go back to Judge Ellis. Judge Ellis gave, in a sense, because perhaps a plea is the scariest day of the defendant's life, and maybe these are the kinds of discussions you should not have with your counsel in just a five-minute break, but something that should happen over the course of days, and that's what they then had the opportunity to do. But the reason there was never a going back to have this plea entered was because he never got to the point where he could accept responsibility for his conduct.
Does a defendant have a constitutional right to consult with his lawyer in private during a Rule 11 colloquy?
Not always, Your Honor.
Are you saying sometimes he does? Sometimes he has a constitutional right and sometimes he doesn't?
Your Honor, I don't want to answer the question incorrectly. But I will say this. I think there's, under these circumstances, I would say no.
What is your answer? Generally speaking, is there ever a situation where a defendant has a constitutional right to consult with his counsel in private during a Rule 11 colloquy?
No. And especially under these circumstances, Your Honor, where with 3 weeks before trial, they had every opportunity to consult after the fact. He was not denied a right to counsel. This was about, for Judge Ellis was proceeding in the most prudent and careful way, not only to protect the record, but to protect the rights of this defendant, to make sure that he knew and completely understood exactly what he was doing. And the defendant had every opportunity to do so. And the fact that he was denied the benefit of pleading guilty and saving himself from a life sentence was due to his own conduct, not any conduct by the court. He had, and that's something else I want to correct, counsel alludes to the fact that he didn't have the same plea offer. Counsel wasn't part of those discussions below. Count three came into play on the day of trial. Our negotiations and discussions in relation to the original plea offer continued. So there was nothing, he didn't lose anything on that day. If he had been able and willing to accept responsibility, he could have placed himself in the exact same position. He chose not to do that, and now he has to live with those consequences. I think this was gamesmanship on his part, because even before trial, one of the witnesses against him was his girlfriend, and he spoke with her on the phone prior to the trial and told her, you're the only witness against me. Don't come.
When I'm looking at page 64
of the transcript,
the defense attorney says, may I have a five-minute recess? And the judge never responds to that. Would you characterize the lack of response by the judge? Is it a denial? Is it a refusal to rule? Is it an indication he didn't hear? What's the government's position on why there was no response made to that question?
I'm not even sure at that point Judge Ellis heard the defense attorney or not.
Because the court reporter heard it.
Pardon me?
The court reporter heard it. You didn't hear my question, but the court reporter heard this one.
I'm sorry.
Why wouldn't we presume the judge heard it if the court reporter heard it?
Perhaps because the only reason I say it is because he didn't respond. And typically I think Judge Ellis would respond to a question from counsel like that. But also, Your Honor, I would say even if you take it as a denial of his request for a continuance, under these circumstances, where the defendant has denied, you know, at this point it was 4 or 5 times, he's saying that the very statement of facts he's there before the court on is untrue. I think, and it was just what the court was alluding to in your question, to allow them to talk for 5 minutes and then come back and then everything is cleaned up, is just inviting, you know, a problem with that plea and a question of whether or not it was truly knowing and voluntary. Unless there are further questions from the court, I will.
Okay, thank you. Let's hear the reply.
Very briefly, Your Honors. I'd like to address the government's statement regarding what was available and what was not available about regarding the offer that was stayed open after this plea didn't work out. And I think the record is far from clear on this point. And I think that if counsel wants to make a proffer about what happened in the court below and what happened in the course of negotiations between the defendant and the government, then I'll make a proffer that my understanding of the situation was after this plea, the government's position changed drastically. While they were technically keeping count 2 open, the consequences of pleading to that count were not the same. So the government's point regarding coming back within the next 3 weeks is not, I don't think that the record supports it, and the court should not take that into account. Secondly, I think the government implies just in its last point that if Mr. Juarez had an opportunity to talk to his attorney, something untoward would have happened. And I think that is not a fair implication. His attorney is an experienced attorney, and I don't think it's fair to presume that he would do something improper. I think that if anything in that situation, any attorney in that situation would proffer truthful facts that would satisfy the elements of the offense.
Well, we've had situations where what the lawyer tells them is something the lawyer honestly believes and is trying to fulfill his ethical responsibility. He's just wrong. On the law.
He could certainly be wrong on the law, Your Honor. There's no question about that. But I think that what the point the government raised is that there would be some improper statement, dishonest statement, and I don't think that's fair to Mr. Williams. The main point here, and the overarching point, is whether Mr. Juarez had counsel at this hearing or not. And I think the record is clear and the context is clear that effectively Mr. Juarez didn't have counsel. He might as well have not showed up that day because he couldn't talk to him. Counsel couldn't intercede on behalf of his client. And when he did try to intercede, he was basically ignored by the court. The court didn't engage him at all. And that's the threshold question. Did Mr. Juarez go to this hearing without a lawyer? And I think the record shows that, in fact, even though his lawyer was a warm body, as this court quoted in Smith, he wasn't much more than that. And it wasn't because he wasn't trying. It was because the judge wasn't letting him. And in that situation, prejudice should be presumed because that's a structural error. Thirdly, regarding the government's points about Mr. Juarez's denials, on page 62 of the joint appendix, Mr. Juarez says, "I'm guilty. I was there. I'm guilty." And I think that the government wants to say that he was categorically denying his conduct. Let's not forget that Mr. Juarez, 3 times during the course of the hearing, insisted, even when the judge was prepared to close the hearing down, insisted that he wanted to have his plea accepted by the court. And he made the statement, "I was there, I'm guilty." And if one looks carefully through the record, I don't think he categorically denies any element of the offense. When the only thing he categorically denies and clearly denies is driving a vehicle, but that's not even necessary to meet the element of transportation. I think if Mr. Juarez, instead of reacting to the questioning of the judge, had an opportunity to make a statement regarding what it was he really did, had an opportunity to understand from his counsel what he needed to do to have his plea accepted, I don't think we would be here today. And my very last point, Your Honor, is that regarding this five-minute recess, again, I'd reiterate, the recess was necessary because he couldn't otherwise talk to his client. So I think when the government tries to couch this as a question of a continuance or something like that, that's just simply not accurate. And I think the analysis in Smith makes clear that we first start with the question of, was there effective assistance of counsel? That's a de novo issue. And then we work backwards to, did the court therefore abuse its discretion in not, in that situation, appointing a substitute counsel, in this situation, granting a recess? And I think the first question certainly has to be answered, that he didn't have effective assistance of counsel at that hearing. If there aren't any further questions, Your Honors, I'll conclude.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.